Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley and I am joined this evening for a discussion of Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles by the fartinest cowboy I know, JB.
We're going to talk about movies tonight, Patrick, so go do that voodoo that you do so well.
I thought for sure you were going to go with, excuse me, while I whip this out. If this is your first time listening to the show, you can
anatomically,
find
I really can't make
our website. And, besides, I wouldn't have left. you can find our website at fthismovie.net. Follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. Like our page on Facebook. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us in the iTunes store. Blah, blah, blah. You don't understand how tired I am of saying it, those of you who are sick of hearing it.
Track us down at Chicago Film Critics Society Classic Film Screening.
That's right.
And bend our ear.
So, tomorrow, we're recording this on Monday, March 9th, not to pull back the curtain too much.
Very important to get the dates straight, because we're stuck in a very confusing time conundrum.
Tomorrow, Tuesday, March 10th, I will be introducing screenings of Blazing Saddles at the Elk Grove Cinema in Elk Grove Village, Illinois.
And by tomorrow, he means yesterday.
Yes, exactly.
Because by the time you listen to it, it will have already
happened. This will
have
already happened, so you can't
come. Or will it have?
So JB had the great idea that we do it for this week's show. That way, anyone who comes out to the screening, if they want to hear us talk more about Blazing Saddles, they can listen to this podcast. I saw it more as a rehearsal. So I thought, hey, I'm probably going to repeat a lot of the things that we talk about tonight at tomorrow/yesterday's screening.
And I'm trying to figure out, because the theater is a stone's throw from a certain public high school, if I could perhaps mosey over during lunch and see how the afternoon screening is going. But please, if you're listening to this Wednesday, because you were at the screening Tuesday, understand that now, Monday, we have no knowledge of what happened at the screening.
That's true.
That crazy stalker who tackled you to the ground, and it looked like he was gnawing on your head. That's not happened yet.
No. The fire has not made the news yet. It hasn't happened.
But that went dark.
What? I was being tackled and eaten. What are you talking about?
Fire.
I didn't go.
Fire bad. Fire bad.
So we're going to talk about Blazing Saddles shortly. But first, J-Bones, let me ask you this. Have you seen anything good lately?
Yes. I was mopping up from last year. The movies that one has not seen. Or perhaps they didn't get out here till a little later. And approaching it, as I think a lot of people did, as some sort of school assignment, I went to see Still Alice.
Yes.
And I was expecting sort of a Lifetime movie with a Julianna Moore performance grafted to it.
Okay.
And the whole thing seemed designed to finally get her the Oscar that she deserved for every other performance she's ever given. And I was really pleasantly surprised.
Okay.
Part of it might be that I've had some experience a little bit with the subject matter, but compared to what I thought it was going to be, which was sort of simplistic and tear-jerky, it was surprisingly nuanced. It was surprisingly low-key. The filmmaker surprisingly gave you a lot of credit for being intelligent.
Okay.
And for being able to figure things out. They did a real good job not making Alec Baldwin, who plays the woman's husband, to not turn him into this villain, but to explain that people have their reasons and that disease that touches everyone in a different way. It was 10 times better than I thought it was going to be. I actually think she deserved it. She deserved the Oscar, even though it's become this old saw that you have to portray.
You have a disease.
Yeah.
Right. She was very good in the movie. She's always good, so it's hard to judge, you know.
Well, I didn't know you had seen it.
Yeah. And it seemed like this year, and I might have brought this up last week because we talked about this movie for a minute, that this year the best actress race wasn't really a race. People weren't talking about it. It was always just, well, it's Julianne Moore, right? She had a disease. She is good in the movie. I agree with everything you're saying. I still felt like, from a filmmaking perspective, it felt a lot like a TV movie to me. Though I agree, it could have been far more heavy-handed, far more awards-baity than it was.
There was a little bit more ambiguity to it that a Lifetime movie would have demonized Alec Baldwin for making.
And I brought this up on the show last week, but the scene when they're out for ice cream late in the film, I thought that was really good.
Yeah.
Really good. And I think they should make a sequel, and it should be called Still Alec.
And it made me really see the tragedy behind his character, because even though it's for better or worse, you have a wife, and then one day you have a child.
Right.
That you're taking care of a child.
Right.
I also thought the quote from Angels in America, and I'm talking about the last scene in the film, was very moving, and I thought the film earned the
right
to quote from perhaps a more layered, better work. I think you have to be really careful when you start throwing quotes around.
Sure.
This
was a play, and I didn't realize that.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
And then a couple days ago, I saw Chappie. You know.
All right. I'm really glad you saw it, because I feel terrible. I had planned to see it this weekend. I was going to review it for the site. In fact, Adam Riske and I sometimes will go back and forth and kind of hash out, like, well, you do this and I'll take this. And he had said, are you going to see Chappie or can I do it? And I said, actually, I kind of want to see it, and I was going to write the review. He said, okay. And then I let him down and everyone else down, because I did not get out to see it because I have sick people at my house. 2015 has been a rough year for me so far, so I apologize for not getting a review of Chappie up, but I'm glad you saw it, so now we can talk about it and service our loyal listeners. Tell me about Chappie.
The film falls prey to something Patrick has talked about and something the two of us have talked about endlessly in the past, that we have at the film's center, I think, is the film that the director wanted to make. The film that's really interesting and talks about things that human beings should be interested in, but unfortunately that movie also needs a lot of special effects. And then suddenly when the budget rises to a point where we can have all these expensive digital effects, well, folks, it's gotta be an action movie. So the film suffers from too many villains. The film suffers from, it's just bewildering how obvious it is that this is two and sometimes three movies battling each other for supremacy.
Could the same thing be said about his previous two movies? Although they are more successful in varying degrees, perhaps I have not seen Chappie. But I think a lot of what you're saying in terms of, like, it starts with an idea that's interesting and then it turns into a special effects action movie is true of District 9 and Elysium as well.
But I think in District 9, there was a sense, well, first of all, because it was a completely unknown quantity, and
right.
we didn't know what we were going to get. Although with District 9, I think cleverly or not, the trailer was selling one thing, and the trailer cleverly only really gave away the first third.
Right.
And there's a point in that movie where it just goes to a completely different place, and I think people welcome that because that doesn't happen very much anymore.
Right.
What we get is a 20-minute short film about artificial intelligence and what that might be like. And then there's this horrible 15-minute segment at the beginning where, you know, you could say it owes something to other films, but it's, can we just say it? It's RoboCop. I mean, it's RoboCop. This was successful once. Let's do it again. It's got this Hugh Jackman performance grafted on it that the film doesn't need. It has this secondary villain that the film certainly doesn't need. And then, and I don't want to give anything away in case you're actually going to go to Chappie and you want to be entertained by it, but the scriptwriter and the filmmakers make some decisions at the end that make you wonder if they had ever seen a movie. I am not a shrinking violet, but my wife and I are sitting there and we're like, oh my God, WTF, and not in the good way.
Okay.
Not in the good way that, oh, we are being taken to a place where we've never been. We're being taken to a place that we don't want to go.
Okay.
We're being held hostage by a movie. I think it's a mess.
That's most of what I've heard, that it's a mess.
And in the immortal words of you, you're watching the movie and you can see the different color script pages. Sigourney Weaver shows up for 10 minutes.
That's kind of her gig now, right?
To collect
a
check.
She walks on to a movie.
And she's completely wasted, and Hugh Jackman is even completely wasted. Better edit that out. Ooh, Freudian slip. They make Hugh Jackman's character religious for some reason.
Because he's the villain too, right? That's
and
novel.
It just comes across as, I'm no fan of religion, but what they do to religion in this film is really awful because, oh, now to make him even worse, he's a religious hypocrite.
Well, and is that also because it needs an opposing viewpoint for artificial intelligence?
Yes, that right. It's Hugh Jackman who
believes. Man shouldn't play God. God is God.
And there should be...
Wolverine is God.
There should be a man. Hugh Jackman is working on a robot where there's a human being who controls it.
Oh, that's better.
And then, spoiler alert... Once his machine goes into action, he's worse than any possible, so hit me over the head with the large brown Wolverine claw of obviousness.
See, we're them, they're us. Patricia Tallman was right.
And I was talking to my wife about this, and I'm not very good at a South African accent, but there's a quality to the dialogue in the middle of this that'll just drive you crazy. Because they have to treat the robot like it's a baby, and because they have these very unusual accents, and in one case, the actress who plays the blonde-haired woman with the odd voice.
The rapper.
Because she has such odd cadences. The dialogue gets into this rhythm that will drive you crazy. And then later that day, I couldn't get it out of my head. Do you see this? Do you see this? Chappie, do you see this? And then Chappie responds, and this is mommy, and it's just a mommy, and it's a mommy, and a Chappie, it's a Chappie, it's a, and then a Chappie, oh, Chappie wanted to, Chappie. I would say you could have a drinking game whenever someone says Chappie,
yeah.
But you'd be in the emergency room and you would have alcohol poisoning. 10 minutes in, it's just odd.
Mm.
I would not recommend this film.
I'm sorry to hear it.
It's an annoying mess.
Yeah. All right. That's frustrating. I was no big Elysium fan either.
Nor was I, but again, and I don't think I was tricked. I don't think if I went back and watched it again. District 9.
I liked it when I saw it.
Is a really nice piece of work.
Yeah.
You know, back when they were leaving him alone and letting him make the film he wanted to make. Oh, the actor, the main actor in District 9.
Charlton Copley.
Okay.
Voices
Chappie.
Chappie. Yeah.
So I saw his name in the credit. And I'm like, okay, well, you came up with a trick voice.
He's Neil Blomkamp's De Niro. And
well, I thought he was terrific in District 9.
He was good. He was good and has never been that good since. The
whole thing when he's given the kid aliens the candy.
Yeah.
And it's just this barely disguised hatred and contempt and hypocrisy. I just thought that scene with the candy. Well, you want the sweetie? Sweetie? It's a sweetie?
Again, I remember the first time I saw that movie, we get to the end of the film, and I won't spoil what happens in District 9, but when you get to the end, they show a clip from much earlier in the film, who he was at the beginning,
yeah.
And it really makes you appreciate how good the performance is when you realize how far he's come, and you're like, oh, that's who we started with? That's right. You've not seen the Spike Lee Old Boy remake.
No.
I would almost say see it just for his garbage, terrible performance. It is... on another planet, his performance.
So he's in.
He's in the Spike Lee, okay. Old Boy. And he is on another planet. And I know we talked about this last week's episode about Scarface, so I won't dwell on it too long, but I know you saw it, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Maps to the Stars.
Yes. And this was...
another movie that was almost reviewed.
One of those cases where... We're canoodling about the On Demand, and there's the new David Cronenberg film. And this was 2 weeks before it opened at the Music Box. It opened at the Music Box, the happiest place on earth, last Friday. So I've got $7 in 2 hours. It's a mess.
Yeah.
It's a big mess. Redeemed a little bit by a couple performances
sure.
that I thought were interesting. Cronenberg is not very good at satire, it turns out.
He claims it's not a satire.
And it seems like he would be the one to sort of skewer Hollywood. But I actually think, in a weird way, David Lynch did it better in Mulholland Drive. That sort of, that this is a weird alien planet and you don't know the rules. It began to annoy me how much the stories intersected to the point where, well, you realize about halfway in that information is deliberately being withheld from you so that later it can form this connection. But that's just an odd way to tell a story. I don't think organically the connections add anything to the party except to make it twisty.
Yeah, there's more I would say about that, but it would involve spoilers. Let me ask you this, though. Often that gets compared, when somebody wants to describe that phenomenon, they say, you know, like Crash. But Crash isn't that old. 2005? 2006? Right. Maybe? Surely lots of movies were doing it before Crash. What is the first, can you think of like the first example of that being done in a film?
Well, I'm going back to the silent days, where we're not told something, and then later that there's some sort of connection. I would think that melodramas did it a lot in the 20s, but not to the extent of, in Crash, a lot of its reason for being seems to be
But why is that movie like the cultural touchstone for that? Is that just because a lot of people hadn't seen that done in a movie before? Were they not seeing the movies that did that? I mean,
I would think so, because I think most of the time, and here my touchstone is, of course, D.W. Griffith's Intolerance. For the most part, people don't like a movie to tell different stories and to go back and forth.
Okay.
That has never been a popular trope. Also, most people really can't remember movies much past the last 10 years.
Sure.
That there's that tunnel vision.
Right.
So I think Crash was very popular. Yeah. Certainly at winning the Oscar made more people see it. And remember, I still have an amount of affection for Crash. I know the contempt you hold it in.
It is not a good movie.
But let me just, before we get to Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, well, I got to do what I saw.
I know, but I just want to throw this out.
All right.
In the last couple years, there were two films that seemed to be trying to be Crash Jr.
One was a Paul Haggis movie, right?
Oh, I don't think I even saw that.
I didn't either. I know Liam Neeson was in it. I can't remember what it was called. It just came out last year.
Second person?
First person.
First person.
Yes.
And clearly he was draining that well of whatever droplets it had left. But the Jason Bateman internet one is dangerous.
Disconnect.
And then didn't that Adam Sandler thing about social media?
Oh, yeah, Men, Women, and Children.
And I would argue, if you watch Disconnect and Men, Women, and Children, you will at least acknowledge that Crash did it better.
Maybe. I'd put it over Men, Women, and Children. I'm not positive I'd put it over Disconnect, which is not a good movie.
No. I saw Disconnect in a theater.
It's not good. It might be better than Crash. I don't know.
Disconnect is a movie
for
everyone. Put that on the poster. Disconnect is a movie. F this movie. Disconnect is a movie for my parents' generation who are afraid.
But so is Crash, isn't it? I mean, racism is bad? Whoa, way to blow the lid off, Paul Haggis. And again, I think there are some scenes in that movie that are okay. The car scene is the one that everybody points to. For a good reason. That's a good, suspenseful scene, even without all the racism stuff.
I think that's at the heart of the movie.
Okay.
Very few standard Hollywood films let people be more than one thing.
Right.
And I would argue, because film is the most important art form of the 20th century, the jury's still out on the 21st, that if more movies allowed characters to be more than one thing, people wouldn't have this belief that everything is black and white and everything is cut and dried. You can be a villain and a hero.
Right.
And that's something that Hollywood is very uncomfortable with.
Sure, sure.
And that's at the heart of Crash, and that's the main
reason. That's at the heart of that scene.
That's
and not the rest of the movie. That's not true. Sandra Bullock learns to not be mean to her maid. What did I see? I'll go through mine real quick. One is a found footage horror film.
Another one?
Can you believe it? I kept being told this one is different, this one is better. And it's actually interesting that you brought up Still Alice. So it's called The Taking of Deborah Logan. And the conceit for this one, because they all have to have, like, a gimmick. So this one is, it's a film crew that's shooting a documentary about a woman named Deborah Logan, who is played by an actress named Jill Larson, who I'm familiar with because she was on a soap opera that my mom used to watch and that my wife watched for some time. So I recognized her from that, and she's very good in the movie, as is the actress who plays her daughter, whose name is Anne Ramsey, and she was on Mad About You, if you used to watch that show. I didn't, but I know I remember her being
on. No,
her.
I know Anne Ramsey.
I'm always confusing her with Goonies, Throw Mama from the Train.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't her name also Anne Ramsey?
I believe she may have spelled Anne differently.
She might have. Different Anne Ramsey. That one's dead. So they're doing a documentary about this woman who has Alzheimer's. And then slowly you start to find out, oh, it's actually something other than Alzheimer's that's going on.
Turns out it's the Alzheimer's monster.
That's going on.
The monster kills you, and then he forgets that he killed you, and he kills you again.
Really interesting. Really interesting first half hour, when a lot of it is just the stuff about the Alzheimer's stuff. And then it gets to a whole middle section where I just felt like it sagged. And I've heard the filmmakers interviewed, and they said they were really trying to beat that problem where in every found footage movie, it gets to a point where if it were real, which so many of them are trying to convince you of, they would stop filming. They would not be doing the things that they're doing. They would put the cameras away and run away or whatever. And that their movie, they really tried to not do that. But I would argue that they do the exact same thing as every other found footage film. This one I think is a little bit better because of the performances. I think the story is more interesting than just like, let's see if ghosts are real. Oh shit, man, ghosts are real. And it builds to an image that is almost worth seeing the movie alone for. It's one of the craziest things you'll see in a movie in a long time. And that moment alone is almost like, well, I'm glad I stuck around for 90 minutes because that was worth it. It's on Netflix Instant. If you are interested, it's a slightly better found footage movie than a lot of others that have been coming out, but I still don't think it's a complete success. Hmm. There was a, oh, okay. So I'm putting together this list of movies, for another site. I'll share it when it goes public, but movies from 1985, which was one of our FS Movie Fest themes. And so I finally got around to seeing Smooth Talk.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's really good.
Now, let's make sure we're talking about the same film. We're talking about a film with Laura Dern and
Treat Williams.
Oh, no. It's.
I had been reading about it for years because Roger Ebert was a fan.
Talk about a film that gives you credit for being intelligent.
And I had never seen it. And
oh, it's terrific.
It's really something. And it takes such a long time to get where it's going.
Yeah.
I mean, for about an hour. And mm-hmm. then the last half hour is where the movie is like, and here's what the movie is. But even the first hour I thought was really interesting and a really honest or accurate portrayal of a certain, like, teenage girl experience. I say this having never been a teenage girl. Minus a few weeks in the 80s. but a look at, you know, the teenage girl experience, I thought her relationship with her mother, played by Mary Kay Place, I thought that was really interesting and good. And then, of course, the last half hour with Treat Williams is something else. So that's really good. I recommend that. And
that's almost a candidate for an overlook because it's never shown anymore and it's not talked about anymore.
Not really. And really, really great performances.
And when that came out, everyone was prophesying great things for the director. And
whose name I can't remember.
And look what happened.
Yeah. But really worth tracking down if you've never seen it. And then,
I'm glad you saw it.
Yeah, really good. The last movie I'll mention, I saw Digging Up the Marrow again I've seen it a couple of times now, twice for other
reasons.
But this
was special.
This was special.
I saw pictures of this on the Facebook.
So I saw it once to review it, once to do an interview, and then they were screening it in a theater in Chicago. So I was like, well, showing in a theater. Adam Green was going to be there, so I really wanted to go. It was at a theater I didn't even know existed in Chicago.
And this is?
The New 400?
Oh, yeah.
I had never even heard of it.
Oh, yeah.
And not a theater that I would have I don't know how it was chosen for
when
this.
I was in high school, I actually went to the original 400, okay, which was legendary, and now we have...
And it used to be one screen.
Yes.
And then they changed it to two, and now I think they've broken it into four pretty small screens, like shoebox theaters.
That's the day and age, but when, in the 70s and 80s, the 400 was... a place.
I remember it being the 400. So am I just confused? I just wasn't familiar with it being the New 400. It just used to be the 400.
Yes.
So maybe that's why I thought I'd never heard of it. I don't know how it got booked. The only thing I could figure is it's an independent, or it's near a college. And so they thought maybe the college kids would come out.
Northwestern's not too far.
Loyola's right there. Mm. And no press was done for it. Anyway, it was fun. The other two times that I had seen the movie, I was by myself, once on my screen, once on my computer. So it was really fun to see it with an audience that was very loud and vocal. There were jump scares in the movie that even though I knew the jumps were coming, I jumped. I had a lot more fun with it this time than I had the previous two times. And I like it. I had written something brief about it on the site last week. And it inspired some debate in the comments because some of our listeners were not as big of fans as I was. I still like it. If for some reason after you've heard this, you have an opportunity to see it in a theater, I don't know how many more times it's screening. I think that night was really the only time it was going to screen theatrically, except for maybe once more at the Draft House.
It seems perfect. You should go. For midnights at the Music Box.
Yeah.
That they need to expand their midnight programming beyond the
room
and Rocky Horror.
Yeah, they recycle a lot of stuff there.
As I predicted with the digital age, with everything on a hard drive, we're going to basically get to a point where there's five midnight movies.
Oh, that's too bad.
This is the movies you want to see. But you had mentioned what a kick it was to see Digging Up the Marrow.
Mm-hmm.
In a theater, and I'm hoping the same thing happens tomorrow night when you show Blazing Saddles transition.
Yeah,
because
I like it.
Watching it Saturday in my home made me really want to see it again with an audience, which I haven't done since I think 77. I briefly wrote about this in a previous column about getting carded.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's at the same theater, but not the same theater. Because the Elk Grove was one of the original Jerry Lewis cinemas that went dark, and for years it was empty, and it was a rat hotel. And then they brought it back, and it was two screens,
yep.
And that's when you used to go.
Yeah,
when
I used
you were
to
a kid.
Walk there every Saturday. My first movie, I bring this up, the first movie I ever saw there was Bird on a Wire. I've talked about it before on the site. Last night I'm laying in bed trying to fall asleep. Bird on a Wire comes on. My wife loves it. I leave it on. I turn the sound way down. And here's a neat experiment. Sometime, turn on Bird on a Wire. Turn the sound way down. The only thing that cuts through is Goldie Hawn screaming. Guess what? She screams for 4/5 of that movie. It was just a constant high-pitched
scream. Why did I bother
scream.
To turn this down?
Yeah, right.
And so the theater that we're now speaking of was demolished.
Yes.
And from its ashes rose a much bigger theater.
Yeah.
With a lot more screens.
Yeah.
But when that Elk Grove Cinema went into business on opening night, I was there, they showed 8 or 10 classic films, and you had your choice, and it was hard to pick because, well, this is in this.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And I wound up going with The Searchers. And this is before digital, so they're showing a print.
That's a good pick.
And it was great, because the first time I ever went to see Blazing Saddles was at the old, talking about the New 400,
Jerry Lewis,
the old Elk Grove Cinema, and it was the only time in my life I've been carded, and I was 15.
Okay.
So they would not let me in. And even at that young age, I knew that Blazing Saddles was originally given a PG, and that Brooks asked for the R. But the ticket seller would not hear this, and so my friends and I had to drive to the nearby Arlington Theater, which cheerfully sold me a ticket, and I finally got to see Blazing Saddles. So I have not seen Blazing Saddles, boy am I bad at math, 38 years. Yeah. I haven't seen in a theater in 38 years. And I'm wondering what the audience reaction tomorrow night will be like.
And some of that, I think, depends on if they've seen the movie. Sometimes these screenings get people who have never... I know, remember, you had said you went to the Blues Brothers, and it was like a lot of new people. And I don't know if they're brand new to Blazing Saddles, how much they will laugh. I think if they've seen it a lot, they'll laugh a lot because it just plays like greatest hits.
Right. And I wanted to talk about greatest hits because as I watched it Saturday night, I began to think of something I've always called the FM theory. That when something gets really popular, it gets shown a lot. I think recently we're seeing this. There are three cable stations that are virtually running Jaws on a 24-hour loop. And maybe Jaws has always been that popular, because God knows it's always been popular. But when I was a teen, there were radio stations that would play the same songs over and over. And the effect is, I can no longer listen to The Who. There's a limit to how many times. So I'm watching Blazing Saddles Saturday night, and I'm thinking, some of this is so familiar to me that when the film first came out, this was considered groundbreaking. But it's hard to see it as groundbreaking when you're seeing it for the 30th or 40th time.
Sure.
Or when it's been imitated and discussed and VH1's top 10 farting scenes or something, that it's become part of the culture.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't seen it nearly as many times. I've maybe seen it three or four times. And I still feel like it has the ability to feel transgressive at times.
Well, there's one thing.
Not the farting stuff, obviously.
No, if you want to get into it, and I think we should.
We might as well. It's the theme of this week's podcast.
Transgressive?
Yeah, Blazing Saddles.
Oh, Blazing Saddles. That, it plays fast and loose with the N-word.
Yeah.
And, I give the film a lot of credit for doing that, because my guess is at the time the film takes place, that word was used a lot.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think, and I don't even like to, I know this for sure, that part of what Mel Brooks was trying to do was explode the word. And so certainly it comes across as an anti-racist film, and so you can't fault it for that. But even as an old man, it's amazing to me that you could do that in the 70s, and at least that part of the film could not be made today.
Absolutely not.
And one would think, well, thank God, because we're so much... But I don't see that as a positive thing.
No, I don't either. Because the movie is being made to mock people.
Right.
The people who would use that word to point out their cruelty and their stupidity. And yes, we should still be able to do that.
To show idiots behaving like idiots.
Right. I
mean, and it's not even implicit. There's that wonderful scene where Gene Wilder is trying to make Cleavon Little feel better.
Right.
And saying,
right,
you have to understand, these are normal, average people. These are people of the land.
Right.
You know, morons. I mean, it's...
And somebody even points out in that featurette, like, that's the movie right there. That is the thesis of the movie, when Gene Wilder says, you know, morons. Yeah, absolutely. It's weird, because I remember watching 48 Hours and feeling like, this feels edgy and dangerous, and yet this movie is, you know, 30 years old, and we couldn't do this today, and
I don't want this to be misinterpreted. I'm not sitting here
We're not saying, asking for more racism.
We need more movies where white people feel free to throw that word around.
No.
We need to have a climate where filmmakers are entitled or allowed to explore these issues, especially in a comedy,
right,
in the way they see fit. I often wonder when I watch it if we would see the film differently, or if its place in comedic history or something would be different had Richard Pryor been allowed to play Bart.
I think so. I think he brings so much cultural baggage with him. And I actually, I can't say it would be a better or a worse film, but Richard Pryor had a lot of anger. You know, he was an angry, angry guy. And I think would have carried that into the role. And I think any time anybody used that word, our response, just knowing Richard Pryor and his comedy and his history, we would have been almost waiting for Pryor to turn around and just punch the guy in the face. One of the things I love about the Cleavon Little performance is just how nice he is.
Yeah.
He's just such a nice man.
At one point, Wilder says, "What is a sparkling urbanite like you right. doing in this place?"
Right.
And this comes up in several of the featurettes that are on the Blu-ray, that Wilder would certainly bring to it something where we would look back and we would remember he was this famous stand-up comedian, and he would bring that to the film. But that ultimately, Brooks says he's really glad and lucky that Cleavon Little played it, because Cleavon Little was an actor
right.
who brought something to it
right.
that's very different.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to just briefly mention before we move on was, I find it interesting that on the stand-up stage, no one was sharper, no one was more pointed, no one was more profane, you know, just heap adjectives. Richard Pryor is one of the five greatest stand-up comedians of all time. I think that's, no yeah. one's going to argue with that. But I also always find his film work to be oddly subdued and, dare I say it, step-and-fetchitus.
Okay.
That's not an adjective, but that, especially as his career went on, he kept specializing in the frightened Negro. So in Bingo Long, Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings, and Lady Sings the Blues, there's none of that. And then in Silver Streak, he's called upon to do that, and then he does it in Stir Crazy. And frequently, I find he was rewarded financially for playing the black man who's always scared. I mean, think of him in Superman 3.
Yeah.
And it's really shameful that his cinematic legacy, at least, would be the opposite of a stand-up legacy.
Yeah, I remember as a kid not being totally aware of Richard Pryor,
the stand-up. Think of the toy.
Right. I didn't know his stand-up. I mean, he had a children's show that I watched and called Pryor's Place. But I was aware that he was a stand-up and had this other career, and that all of his movies were kind of bad. And I was always aware of that disconnect. Like, Bill Cosby, you're this great stand-up. You're on the number one TV show in the country, and yet you can't be a movie star. And we see it again happen with Chris Rock. And I'm not drawing a correlation between their races, only the fact that they are stand-ups who tried again and again, Cosby less so, to have a film career. And I just don't think Richard Pryor ever really had a super successful film career, but I say that as somebody who was born after most of his best movies were made.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen all of his pairings with Gene Wilder. And I think, you know, some of his best stuff is like Blue Collar when he's not even doing comedy, you know. But yeah, I grew up on The Toy.
And that's early.
And Movin', Movin'.
I find there's this trajectory to his career where more and more and more he plays parts that he would have made fun of on stage.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. I'm not the world's biggest Mel Brooks fan. I don't know who is.
And there was a period of time where I would say that I was.
Okay.
There was a period in the 70s where I was aware of the producers in 12 Chairs, although I didn't see those till later. I was a really big fan of Young Frankenstein, which I think you might be able to argue is his best film in terms of it being a whole package
right.
where it looks good, the story's being served. And I always put that down to the fact that that's the one film he wrote with Gene Wilder. And I always wished he would have continued to write with Gene Wilder, because Gene Wilder breaks away. And just like other comedy teams, you see Mel Brooks making movies and Gene Wilder making movies like Sherlock Holmes' The Smarter Brother and things like that. And you're actually sitting there thinking if those two sensibilities
right.
could be put back together
right.
because they complete each other. But Producers is terrific, although clumsily made. 12 Chairs.
I still haven't seen the 12 Chairs.
12 Chairs, I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
And Blazing Saddles was the film that put him on the map.
Yeah.
And Blazing Saddles was a tremendous, tremendous success and allowed him to make Young Frankenstein. But what I'm really talking about in the 70s is I discover the comedy albums that he made with Carl Reiner in the 60s. In fact, frequently, show you what a nerd I am, when I was in college, my roommate and I would listen to those at night when we went to sleep over and over and over. And I still think they're among the best comedy albums ever made. And one of the biggest parts of this was Mel Brooks would go on talk shows and just kill. He's quick. Mm-hmm. I would argue that he's better on the talk show than some of the movies.
Sure.
Recently, there was one of those American Masters specials on PBS about Johnny Carson.
Okay.
It was narrated by Kevin Spacey. It's on Netflix right now.
Okay.
And I was surprised at how many clips there were of Mel Brooks as a guest, just killing it. So I think it was the 1-2 punch. I'm listening to these comedy albums that were actually from 10 years before. I'm seeing him on TV on a regular basis. He once did Donahue, like live at Chicago Fest, at Taste of Chicago.
Okay.
So there was like this audience of 2,000. I mean, I still remembered. It was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And then I'm a budding film fan, and that's when he starts doing parodies of movies. I think after Young Frankenstein, the films just slowly start going downhill.
Yeah, I mean, there's some funny stuff in some of the movies that come after.
But I think you can see the seeds of, I don't want to call it his downfall, because there's people who love those films, and those films are very successful, that he never breaks free of the your show of shows sketch mentality.
Okay.
And so most of his films are a question of,
right,
there are pieces that work and pieces that don't.
Right. And Blazing Saddles, I don't know if it taught him a bad lesson, but because it was so successful, that this is the Mel Brooks that I grew up knowing. He's the Weird Al of comedy filmmaking.
Yeah.
Every movie is a different style parody. So here's his Hitchcock one, here's his Star Wars one, here's his Universal Monster movie one, here's the Western.
The silent movie,
the epic History of the World, yeah, or whatever. There's a few that don't fit in. Life Stinks,
Life Stinks, I never saw, 12 Chairs. To Be or Not to Be.
To Be or Not to Be, right, just remaking
Jack
Benny.
But like you said, I think Blazing Saddles taught him the lesson that something more heartfelt and certainly sweeter, which is 12 Chairs, well, that doesn't make any money. That's
right.
Not successful.
Right.
So it's got to be joke fest.
And again, having not seen 12 Chairs, I know that the only three movies of his that I really like are part of that first group of four, because like you, after Young Frankenstein, I'm kind of done.
It's diminishing returns.
And I grew up I'm of a generation that swears that Spaceballs is great, and I do not think Spaceballs is great.
I saw Spaceballs on my honeymoon.
I know.
I did. I'll avoid the obvious joke. So I think with Blazing Saddles 2, I think maybe the reason why it was so successful was because it was something very new. But I would also argue that, like Young Frankenstein, more of it works than doesn't work.
Yeah.
So there's a much higher ratio of funny stuff to stuff that maybe doesn't work, which is interesting when you consider how many people worked on it. On one of the featurettes, Andrew Bergman tells the story that he had written the original story, and I think it was supposed to be called Tex X, and it was about 70s attitudes,
right,
put back into the Old West, and then that's where they got the central idea, and then they changed the name to Black Bart, and that's when Mel Brooks came on board and a whole bunch of other writers. And Andrew Bergman to this day says he's surprised that they didn't just buy him out, that they kept him on, and he was able to write jokes with them, because it's a very jokey movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, every Mel Brooks movie is, and that's to be commended, but sometimes I think that's part of what leaves me cold about Mel Brooks or other filmmakers who sort of adopt this approach, this idea of, well, let's throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. Because for every 9 jokes that don't land for me, one does. And that's what I end up doing, is I appreciate the sheer number of jokes, right? Even if they didn't all make me laugh, I like that they're literally trying every 5 seconds. Here's something new.
And the show needs jokes. There
right,
are plenty
right.
of modern comedies who don't understand
no.
that you have to have jokes.
And they'll take a long time to set up a joke that doesn't land. So I appreciate, but it's just that I sit through the 9 kind of groaning, so that by the time the 10th one rolls around, I laugh, but I'm still stuck on those 9 that I'm just like, oh, that was so lame. Even just the Howard Johnson joke, the work that he does to pay off a joke that the guy's name is Howard Johnson.
But I've always thought that was the cherry on the sundae. The joke that I like more is that they're all named Johnson.
I guess, but I really think that's just to set up Howard Johnson. I really think that.
Well, then I'm thinking about it too much, because not only does he get a lot of mileage out of other famous Johnsons, which actually leads to the next thing I wanted to talk about, but it underscores the fact that these are all white Anglo-Saxon. Right. I mean, Johnson is right. A pretty... I was watching it Saturday night, and I wondered, now that the film is 40 years old, how many people will watch it tomorrow night and miss a lot of the references, because a lot of the references are old, and not just stuff like Olsen and Johnson, which I don't expect anyone to get, but... one of my favorite lines, spoiler alert, is Slim Pickens' first line in the film. What in the wide, wide world of sports were you thinking? And that was a television show that was on for a really long time. But it hasn't been on in 20 years.
Yeah, way longer than that.
So,
way longer.
Is this lost, or will the audience remember? Or if the audience is all in their 40s and 50s?
Is it that funny if they do remember?
I think it's a really funny line.
Why?
I think...
I mean, there's no... You can't explain why something is
right,
funny.
Because one of the tropes of the film is that it's mixing contemporary
right.
with old-fashioned. And it sounds like a Western line. It sounds like a Slim Pickens line.
Sure.
And yet, it's...
Right. I had forgotten, because it had been...
At this point, we're going to get into a fist fight about what's funny and what's not.
Because it had been some years since I had seen it, I always thought it was more about... It was a movie about making fun of, you know, American history, kind of. And to some degree, it is. Although I think by the end, it, like a lot of Mel Brooks movies, just becomes about being a movie. Like, it's just, it's the snake eating its own tail, where it's a movie about it. I mean, there's that scene in Spaceballs that I think you and I have both pointed to as being like,
it's the one funny thing in Spaceballs.
But it's, isn't it the exact same joke in Blazing Saddles?
I'm not sure, but if you're referring to what I think you're referring to...
I honestly can't remember what I'm referring to right now, but I remember watching it the other night saying, they do this in Spaceballs.
When the big brawl breaks through the wall.
Yes.
Literally breaking the fourth wall.
Right.
And we get the musical number.
Right.
And then we get that riot through Warner Brothers Studios.
Right.
That's some of the stuff I like the most.
Sure.
And I wish he had done more than that, than just relied on that for the, sort of the weird ending. Because that whole thing about them going to Grauman's Chinese and shooting the villain and then going inside the theater
That's
to see how the movie ends.
That's what I'm thinking of.
And then suddenly we're back in the movie, but Gene Wilder still has his popcorn.
Right.
And then we go from horses to the limo.
Right.
And that's the end. That sort of weird Twilight Zone bifurcation.
Yeah.
I wish it wasn't just the last 10 minutes.
Sure. Okay. I like it. I mean, I like the fact that...
I think that's one of the transgressive things that still works.
Right. And then it doesn't try to make, like, those demarcations. It doesn't explain, like, well, now we're back in the movie, that it just kind of... anything goes. And that's, one of the things that I like about this Mel Brooks... Because, again, you got to remember, I grew up on Spaceballs and Robin Hood Men in Tights Mel Brooks, which is, like, just not good. I really like this movie's kind of embrace of anarchy. You know, I'm a fan of that approach to comedy, and this movie does it, I think, better than any of his other films, even in its form, as we've just pointed out.
I think the center of the film, and I wish they had actually devoted more time to it, but it's not as jokey, is the relationship between Cleavon Little and Gene Wilder. Because it's very authentic and very sweet. It amazes me that even though Gene Wilder was a very last-minute replacement, he gives one of the most knowing performances in the film. There's this odd karmic reserve to his character.
He seems to be the one character standing outside the whole thing, aware of everything that's going, you know, like he's aware of the time difference. He's aware that he's in modern times and nobody else is. He's aware that, like, these assholes just haven't figured it out yet, and don't worry, because eventually this is going to get better.
And I think maybe that was an observation when Gene Wilder read the script, that in terms of what his character's supposed to be, which is the fastest gun in the West, there's this weird arrogance and calm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's some of my favorite stuff. The thing with the chessboard and grabbing the piece, mm-hmm. and then later when he shoots everyone mm-hmm. and through editing, that you're just above it all.
Right.
Because it's the arrogance of excellence.
Right.
Also, Wilder's speech about why the Waco kid hung up his guns and became an alcoholic,
yeah.
that's really funny. He nails it. That is a really funny speech with a terrific payoff. And I'm looking forward to hearing that tomorrow night at the theater.
Yeah.
So on the top, you have the Cleavon Little Gene Wilder stuff.
All right.
That makes me wish there was more.
Right.
And then in the middle, I think you have a lot of the genre stuff with Mel Brooks making fun of specific tropes of the Western.
Sure.
Which I think works really well. And then, please agree with me, on the bottom.
Okay.
You have the Harvey Korman, Mel Brooks stuff that's like a bad vaudeville turn or a bad television show. It's even shot oddly with the large-breasted secretary in a bikini from the producers.
Right.
And the two of them doing shtick, and he's got Gov on the back. I mean, it's just...
He does all the same stuff in Spaceballs. Not the Spaceballs. Spaceballs, for whatever reason, is the Mel Brooks movie that I saw the most, again, because it was the one that I kind of grew up on. All of those scenes are in Spaceballs as
and
well.
Oddly enough, before a little bit earlier, I was talking about how ubiquitous Mel Brooks was on television. I would argue, before Spaceballs came out, between newspaper interviews and television, he gave away every joke.
Yeah.
So I still remember sitting down in a theater, and I'm like, oh, Pizza the Hut. He had given that away on television.
Right.
And yogurt and the Schwartz. And it's
none
like,
of which are funny, by the way. None of which are funny. The point is this. I think Harvey Korman is like giving a funny Harvey Korman performance, but...
I will say he's given the thinnest material.
But he doesn't, yeah. I mean, just even how many times he has to correct people. It's Headley and no payoff. It's just, I just do it again and then they still get my name wrong and ha 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 ha.
He might think the payoff is at Grauman's, but that's not a payoff because
no.
It's just, here's her feet.
Right,
and
right.
A much better payoff, I think, not that I'm going to start quoting the film, is that he shot... And his dying words are, he's looking at the footprints of Douglas Fairbanks. And his dying words are, how did he do all those stunts with such little feet? This is what makes us love Mel Brooks, that sort of thing. I mean, you want to talk about stuff being off the wall.
And I didn't realize until researching it a little bit, watching it the other day, that Madeline Kahn was nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah.
Which has to be, again, one of those Judi Dench network, what's her name in Network? Where you do just like the one scene.
Oh, Ned Beatty as the...
No, the
wife.
Oh,
Beecher Strait.
Yeah, Beecher Strait, thank you. Because she's really not in the movie very much.
She does this one turn, and I really thought, again, watching it Saturday night, that scene doesn't work at all.
No.
And unless people were, like, patting themselves on the back for knowing that she was doing Marlena Dietrich, and Marlena Dietrich had kind of a speech impediment, maybe for the time, some of the lines in the song are risque, but... I much prefer the opening song, and the story they always tell is that Frankie Lane, who recorded it, thought it was a really great song and thought it was going to revive his career
yeah.
and didn't realize it was a joke.
Right.
But it's a fairly subtle joke.
Yeah.
Something the film does not have a lot of.
I was revisiting it the other day, and I'm watching the opening titles, and it's that great, you know, kind of Panavision shot, and the song is playing, and it reminded me of this last year, around this time, a few months later, when you and I and Adam Risky all sat through A Million Ways to Die in the West,
yeah.
which opens very much the same way. And I remember feeling like, ooh, fun. This is a comedy Western that really respects the Western and is trying to do a Western well. And then, the wheels came off fairly quickly. Where was I going with this? Comedy Westerns, why does one work and one doesn't? I mean, better jokes, obviously, would be... A Million Ways to Die in the West just clearly owes so much to Blazing Saddles. And I really think comes up short. And I say that as someone who I think laughed at it more than you did. But yes. Neither of us liked it as much as Adam Risky.
No. And on one of the featurettes, Mel Brooks tells the story that either he was assigned or he chose Joseph Bierock as the director of photography. And Bierock is old school. And according to Mel Brooks, what Bierock brought to the party was he said, you know you have to make this in widescreen and Technicolor because that's the canvas from where we get the Old West. And this is a problem, I think, because Mel Brooks's films are not known for being particularly technically proficient or particularly pretty.
Which is also why Young Frankenstein is great, and it's too bad that he only did it with these two movies, Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, where he is paying attention to form and that's part of the joke.
That the way it looks is part of it, because then he goes on to Silent Movie, and
which I've never seen.
I watched it again a couple months ago, and I am now of the opinion that it is unwatchable.
Okay.
For any number of reasons. And I remember how excited I was when that came out, because remember, this is another reason why I have so much affection for Mel Brooks. This is at the point where I'm deciding that this is going to be my hobby, if not my life. And he suddenly starts making film homages. This is something I was into.
Yeah. I grew up, High Anxiety was on cable a lot. And I remember seeing it the first time. And it's one of the first times I can really remember feeling like, ooh, I get that. The scene with the newspaper in the shower, I understood that he was doing Psycho. And I don't think I had seen Psycho yet because I was very young, but I knew what it was. And so it was like I suddenly felt a little bit like in on the joke. And I know people are chasing that because we see it all the time where you call it like comedy for morons or a moron's idea of cleverness is the expression that you use all the time. And it is. It's a reference with no joke. It's just trying to like, hey, get it? Do you make this connection? Do you get the reference?
Well, there's a reason.
But I was like seven.
There's a recent example of that in the trailer for Unfinished Business.
Okay.
Franco says, I lost my virginity twice. Okay, that's the joke. And then Vince Vaughn says, that's not the way it works.
Yeah,
you shouldn't need the second line.
That's the Will Ferrell. That's kind of different than what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Family Guy, where it's the reference.
Oh, where that just gets a reference instead of a joke.
So you just say, I know what that's referencing, but there's no joke.
I think there's still a couple things in High Anxiety that work. And then there's stuff that's just odd. And you just think, well, the quality control here is not very high. The two villains are shown to be into S&M, and they're all in this dungeon garb with whips, and it's like, oh, so they're kinky. Okay, I get it. But there's other stuff that works. What bothers me is when Mel Brooks feels he has to underline the joke. And where you see this in his films more than anything else is in the funny signs. There's always funny signs.
Right.
In Blazing Saddles, there's a sign hanging on a fence that says, after 5 o'clock, knock on the barbed wire. And it fills the screen.
Right.
And he has no interest in having that sort of be in the background. And if you see it in Young Frankenstein, brain depository after 5 p.m., slip brains through.
Yeah.
In Life Stinks, there's a hotel, great lodgings for the unassuming. It fills the screen and it sort of mashes your face. And that should be a little cupcake off to the side. And if you catch it, you catch it. If you don't, you don't.
I think one of the problems with later Mel Brooks, and we're kind of off Blazing Saddles and we're just talking about Mel Brooks, but one of the problems with later Mel Brooks is he establishes this as his thing, right?
Yeah.
I do the genre parodies. And you know, Weird Al has been able to sustain it because he's doing specific songs. I don't know. But with Mel Brooks, it hasn't worked because at a certain point, he runs out of, well, I'm going to make this kind of movie. I'm going to make this kind of movie. So by the time we get to Robin Hood, Men in Tights, and I think Dracula, Dead and Loving It, which I haven't seen since the theater, but I remember finding pretty dreadful. He's no longer doing genre parodies. He's just doing a specific movie.
Yeah.
And so then it becomes this Friedberg Seltzer thing that they're doing now, where it's like Robin Hood Men in Tights is really just doing Kevin Costner's Robin Hood with some Errol Flynn thrown in there. But
well, and oddly enough, the genesis of that was really him wanting to recycle some scripts he had done for a 70s TV show. He executive produced it, and I think he wrote some of it, which was called When Things Were Rotten.
Okay.
And there's just joke for joke things. It's When Things Were Rotten recycled
okay.
to the big screen. Dick Gaudier played Robin Hood, and I actually watched that show when I was a kid because wow. I wanted to laugh.
I had something I wanted to go back to with Blazing Saddles. Oh, I like, again... And Mel Brooks is one of the few, he's not one of the few people that have ever done this. I take that back. I think it's rare now for a comedy. I think David Wayne is doing it somewhat. Where you get all different kinds of jokes.
Yeah.
So I think you have some, you know, clever wordplay, ha ha ha. I think you have some really sharp satirical observations. But then you also have a scene where people are farting around a campfire. And it's like, you can pull from all these different styles of comedy. If you don't think this kind of thing is funny, stick around because somebody's going to fall down.
And you have to agree, Blazing Saddles has
exactly.
a bewildering
it's
variety
just every
of
kind
jokes.
Kind of thrown into a blender. And again, on that featurette, did you watch where they show the edited for TV campfire scene?
Yeah.
Because they have to remove all of the farts. So it's just cowboys taking turns kind of sitting
half getting up.
And I don't understand why that's the scene that everyone remembers. Did that make such a cultural impact? Had no one ever seen people fart on film before? Was the toilet flushing in Psycho?
Yes, it was. And another thing I was thinking when I was watching it most recently is that famous quote from Steven Spielberg, who said, in the 70s, if you said the word shit, people would laugh. And that's all over Blazing Saddles. But of course, Steven Spielberg took that knowledge and he turned it into one of the biggest scares in the movie because he said, I want to turn a laugh into a scare.
Yeah.
And that's why Roy Scheider says,
some of this shit.
Come down and chump some of this shit. that swearing to get an easy 70s laugh, it was a weird time.
So do you think the movie holds up? This is probably going to be the first question I ask at yesterday's Q&A.
I think it does as a historical artifact.
Okay.
And I think even though a lot of it is dated and a lot of it doesn't quite work anymore, I think there's enough stuff that's honestly funny to make it worth seeing.
Yeah.
I don't think it should be in AFI's top 10 funny films ever made. In fact, on the featurette, Mel Brooks was claiming, without irony, that he regards it as the funniest film ever made. Funnier even than Some Like It Hot.
Is that what you would say is the funniest movie ever made?
No. Okay. I don't know what the funniest movie
ever made
is. I
don't either, because I think funniest
I don't think it exists, because
that makes sense.
It's so subjective.
Right, right.
I think it's easier to say what the scariest horror film is than to say what the yeah. funniest
yeah.
comedy is.
I think you can make an argument for what the best comedy is, but I don't think any you could pick the funniest.
Well, if you sit there and say, what are the criteria for a comedy?
Yeah.
I think if you chose those criteria, I think Some Like It Hot would be a... oddly enough, I think Some Like It Hot dates better than Blazing Saddles.
No, that makes sense. One more question, and then we'll wrap up again, because I'll probably ask this at yesterday's Q&A.
You mean tomorrow.
Right. When Blazing Saddles came out in the early 70s, audiences had much more of a frame of reference for what the movie was kind of making fun of.
Yes.
And we haven't had Westerns in 30 years, at least. We get a couple a year.
Not even on television. And if anything, Westerns were more ubiquitous
right.
on television
right.
than they were in theater.
So to a new audience, can they even appreciate what the movie is doing and or saying? Because they don't have that reference point.
I don't know, because, you know, for 30 years I taught film study and always did a unit on the Hollywood Western, and it was the unit they were most resistant to, but year after year after year, it was the unit that they grew to love, largely because of The Searchers. So in some ways that speaks to why Westerns were so
mm-hmm.
popular originally, because they speak to something inside of us that, as Americans, we like. I don't know, because I haven't seen Blazing Saddles with a big group of strangers in 38 years, and that's why I'm looking forward to tomorrow night.
Yeah, me too. We'll see what happens. Thanks for talking about Blazing Saddles.
Oh, this was fun.
It was fun. Thank you guys very much for listening. Hopefully the screening goes okay, and if it does, I will talk to you guys next week. And if it doesn't, it's been fun.
And don't talk to the authorities about the fire.